This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When events like Christchurch happen, the elements may indeed be obvious. Guns, hatred, alienation. But the obvious is also reductive and risks obscuring larger forces at play. The same goes with the vocabulary of race violence. White nationalist, white identity, alt-right, white supremacy, white power. They're used interchangeably, which further clouds the picture. Christchurch, says University of Chicago Professor Kathleen Belew, is the latest manifestation not just of resentment and paranoia or even radical racism, but a clearly defined revolutionary movement. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why do you specify white power versus, say, white supremacy?
I think the closest term would be white nationalism. But the thing is that when we talk about nationalism, a lot of people think about sort of an overexertion of patriotism. And the assumption there is that the nation implied in white nationalism is going to be the United States or New Zealand. In fact, the white power movement is interested in a transnational white population that is attempting to seize control of first white homelands and then eventually the world as a white nation. And for this reason, I think white power is a better term for thinking about this in our reporting and in our debating, because it conveys the radical future imagined by this movement. And I think white supremacy is just overly broad. White supremacy is an ideology held in common by many people who have less extremist and less violent political ideologies. And also, white supremacy, of course, describes many elements of our governance, our distribution of resources, our criminal justice system, our courts, right? So being specific about the radical nature of this movement is important.
It's obvious that white racism goes back centuries in this country and abroad. But you place the white power movement at a particular place in American history, namely the end of the Vietnam War. Why then?
So the Vietnam War created a narrative about betrayal by the state that brought Klansmen, neo-Nazis, followers of Christian identity, skinheads, radical tax protesters, white separatists, and more into this common cause. And this was accomplished both by a sense of profound distrust in the federal government and other sort of institutions, and also mobilized by fears of racial annihilation, fears of the end of the white race and being overrun. The Vietnam War is also important here because it dramatically escalated the impact of this movement on civilians, because the white power movement was able to mobilize the weapons and tactics of that war in a kind of paramilitary activism that came home to the United States. I should clarify a little bit what I'm saying, because the number of returning Vietnam veterans who joined this movement is very, very small, statistically insignificant even. But the veterans who did join white power groups had enormous impact on their social and cultural formation, and also on the strategies and weapons that they use.
Now, this period that you describe, post-Vietnam War, occurred just before the Reagan administration, which was very conservative and kind of big government hating, and you would have thought would have been a very satisfying political outcome for the people we're talking about, but no, au contraire.
So this movement turned revolutionary in 1983. It declared war on the federal government and began a string of infrastructure attacks, assassinations, and other actions that were intended to foment race war. The fact that that happened, as you say, during the second term of the Reagan administration and not under a leftist executive indicates that having what people in the center might perceive to be a friendly administration is not going to be enough for activists in this kind of an ideology. They look at someone like Reagan and see him as moderate. They see frustration with the distance between campaign promises and what people can actually put through. And they sort of see this as a referendum that electoral politics are never going to achieve the kind of radical social change they want.
I'm going to talk about ideology for a moment. A recurring theme, it seems to me, is this notion of white genocide. And with that paranoid worldview, a certain word keeps popping up.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
What does that even mean?
people in the white power movement see a whole number of social issues as fundamentally being about a threat to white reproduction. Abortion is a threat because it might kill white children. Immigration is a threat because of the threat of hyper-fertile populations of color overrunning a white nation. LGBT rights and feminism are a threat because they might encourage white women not to bear white children. All of this is felt not as a soft demographic change, but as a real apocalyptic threat.
But let me just observe that it's not just mass murderers in New Zealand or Nazis in Charlottesville. Republican Congressman Steve King said on Twitter, quote, "We can't restore our civilization with someone else's babies." And here's right-winger Laura Ingraham on Fox this week.
Democrats were once the party of ideas, the party of the little guy. Well, the little guy is actually doing much better under Trump, and they know it. So what's their answer? To replace you.
Is there more danger from terrorists or from this ideology seeping into the political mainstream?
Here's one way to think about it. The white power movement is a tiny group of people. In the period of my study, we're only talking about 10 to 75,000 people who are in kind of the inner hardcore ring that might carry out an act of violence or support one. Outside of that, there's another, 150,000 people who do things that are public-facing that are more like attend rallies, buy newspapers, and agree with the ideology. And outside of that, there's another 450,000 people. Now, those people don't buy a newspaper, but they regularly read the newspapers, right? And there's a diffusion of ideas. So then we could imagine that outside of that, which is now a population that's not usually counted, there are probably a larger group of people who would never read something that says, you know, newspaper of the Knights of the KKK, but who would agree with the ideas that are presented in one. And you can imagine that this model of organizing works both to push ideas from that hardcore inner circle out into the mainstream and to pull people in towards the middle who can be radicalized towards racist violence. So I think we have to think really carefully about how fringe ideas move and also about the capacity of these groups to continue recruiting people to do harm.
On the subject of relative danger, I want to come to the question of leadership. The Oklahoma City bombers didn't have a boss. Dylann Roof didn't have a boss. The Christchurch shooter didn't have a boss. And yet they're responding to something central. What and how?
They're responding to a coherent political ideology that lays out a plan of attack. One of the places that we can see this is in the dystopian novel that becomes not only a manual for the movement, but kind of an ideological lodestar. It's called The Turner Diaries, and it's published in the late 1970s and then popularized over the 1980s and forward. The Turner Diaries lays out this incredibly huge end goal, which is not only the successful takeover of the United States, but the annihilation of all people of color all over the world through nuclear and biological weapons. Group leaders are able to sort of spread this idea, get people organized into cells, distribute money to those cells, and then connect them through computer message boards and then through the internet, such that all of these things can kind of evolve independently, but towards a common purpose. What it shows us is that these acts of violence are never supposed to be the end point in and of themselves, but are supposed to awaken this broader white public into race war.
The Turner Diaries has become, as you say, a lodestar, an aspiration for a gathering race war. Is it happening?
In order to really reckon with this kind of violence, we would need to connect these disparate acts by the ideology of the perpetrators. So rather than reporting on, say, the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue as an anti-Semitic crime, the attack on Charleston worshipers as a racist crime, and the Christchurch shooting as an Islamophobic crime, we really have to look at the fact that all of those perpetrators are motivated and connected by the same ideology, the same kind of view of what their violence is supposed to do. We could add many more episodes to that list and do the work of connecting these dots together. Certainly things like the Oklahoma City bombing and Anders Breivik's attack in Norway would belong in that same story. Doing that would create a different kind of reporting that doesn't rely on the idea of lone wolves, but actually does the work of connecting these events together. It would allow a different kind of public conversation about what these events mean. And it would create a different kind of expectation about what kind of surveillance and legal resources need to be dedicated to this moving forward.
Elsewhere in this program, we're considering the other edge of this double-edged sword, however, and that is with the increasing attention, we are buoying the very movement that we're trying to isolate and understand. How do you square that circle?
I profoundly disagree with the idea that we should not talk about this violence. We should call this a manifesto because it is a political ideology and we should understand it as such. I believe we should name the gunman because this is part of a historical project of connecting these acts of violence together. And I also think, not for nothing, this movement wants us not to understand it as a movement. This movement has worked incredibly hard for several decades to appear precisely as the acts of disconnected madmen rather than as a groundswell. The term lone wolf was coined by people in this movement in order to muddy the waters about prosecution and public understanding. When we report this as the work of single actors, even of cells, what we're missing is a huge component of the organizing, which involves deep social ties. This is a movement that rests just as heavily on things like shared childcare and homeschool curricula as it does on leaderless resistance and lone wolf violence, quote unquote. We have to understand all of it in order to organize any kind of social response. And I'll say this too. There have been copycat attacks after all of these acts of violence. There are people who will want to emulate the Christchurch shooting just as they attempted to do that after the actions of the Order in the 1980s or the Oklahoma City bombing. We cannot unring the bell of that viral video. This person is already enshrined in various corners of the internet. But social response, really understanding what this is and devoting appropriate resources and time to combating this violence, we have to understand it.
Kathleen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Ballou is a professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.